Welcome to another edition of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the producer of the show. Today is yet another exception to the rule of focusing on interviewing a book author about a Lewis-related topic. Instead, I'm sharing highlights from the keynote addresses that were delivered at the 2016 colloquium at Taylor University in June. The featured speakers are the same who participated in the panel discussion I previously shared, Diana Glier, Serena Higgins, and Colin Duryea. What follows is about 15 minutes from each of their addresses. First up is Diana's talk about the process of writing and how Lewis and Tolkien often differed. Next, I share Serena's presentation on the life of Charles Williams. And finally, the last third of this podcast comes from Colin's speech on the critical friendship of Lewis and Owen Barfield. There are a couple of things to note about my first and last excerpts. In Diana Glier's talk, which you'll hear shortly, she presented 11 questions for audience members to answer about their process of writing. So because I'm not providing the entire talk, you will only hear her introduction and the explanation to the first question. Finally, Colin Duryea's address was given in a different location, and the acoustics were different than expected. The result was the audio is unfortunately not as good as the first two presentations. In fact, in trying to clean up the audio afterwards, it results in only a better sound if you are using speakers or average quality headphones. Meaning if you have good quality headphones, it might not sound too great. It might sound more like AM radio on a bad day. So I provide it here in hopes you will still be able to understand it enough to glean the information without too much difficulty. With that said, as noted, Diana Glier is first up.
Well, if I were to ask you if you write like J.R.R. Tolkien, you might answer something like, well, I don't really like fantasy, or I write nonfiction mostly, or he's much more descriptive and detailed, and my style is a lot simpler and cleaner than his. Now, if you did answer something along these lines, you'd be thinking about the product that Tolkien produced. You'd be thinking about The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, and you would be saying, in essence, that you don't write the same kind of material that he does, or that your writing style doesn't match his particularly well. If I were to ask you if you write like C.S. Lewis, you might answer something like, well, I don't really write children's stories. You might say, I'm not an expert in Christian apologetics. You might say, I don't use the same level of Christian imagery. Or I don't rely on metaphor the same way that he does in order to create meaning. And again, the focus of those answers is on the product, on the written text, on the kinds of books and essays and poems that Lewis wrote. It's a product approach. We take our finished work, we put it next to Lewis's work or Tolkien's work, and we compare the texts that we see before us. And that's what we usually think of doing when we think about writers. We think about the work that they produce. Textbooks on art criticism still tend to define influence in this way. They compare the final products side by side, looking specifically for similarity. But I've always been fascinated with the process rather than the product. I love to learn about the way that writers write. I'm more interested in finding out how a comment from one person changes the trajectory of an entire vision, or how a challenge from a person or a group can bring out the very best in another. Well, back in the 1980s, I worked for a magazine called CCM. I also worked for Music Line and Cornerstone Magazine out of Chicago. I had a fantastic job back then. I interviewed Christian musicians and I talked with them about what they were working on, what was new and what was next. I often would catch them right after a concert or a new album release Creative people are so much fun to talk with. Writers in particular simply fascinate me, but musicians seem to understand intuitively something important about the nature of collaboration, the way a musician collaborates with the instrument that they play, the way a musician makes music within the context of a space, and the way we as audience actually shape the music that comes forth as we listen and lean in. I am drawn irresistibly to learn more about what happens in the in-between time, in between the moment when there's a spark of inspiration and when that project is incarnate before us, in our hands. What happens between the time when you get an idea for a book and a paper, and then one day that book sits solid and real in your hand? I remember, as some of you know, The Company They Keep took me 23 years to write. And when you work on something for that long, it's really hard to believe that it's actually real. And I have to confess, I did not believe in The Company They Keep until my friend Josh sent me a link to the Amazon page. Isn't that awful that I didn't believe in my own book until I saw it listed for sale on Amazon.com? It seems to me the magic of the process is the same, whether it's a sonnet or a rock song or an academic paper or a fantasy series. I like to think about everything that happens in between the moment that a fresh idea first arrives and the moment we hold the physical work in our hands. I love the creative process. And so today I want to talk a little bit about that process with you. If you don't consider yourself to be a writer, that's okay. You can translate this into whatever art form you practice, whether a musician, a director, an actor, someone who knits or cooks, or perhaps some other kind of work that you do. Tonight I want to leave you with a better understanding of how you work creatively, what sorts of things facilitate your own creative success, and what sorts of things get you really stuck. I want to talk about some of the things that most of us have in common as creators, and some of the ways that we are very, very, very different. As we delight in this conference and the things that we've learned and the people that we've met and the ideas that have sparked here, I want us to begin to think about what we might write and publish as a result of this intellectual feast. I want to offer you some insights into the writing process of C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, how they're alike and how they're different. Since my own training is in rhetorical theory and composition studies, I also want to offer you this, a more nuanced vocabulary to describe the way that writers go about their work. I also want to invite you to think a bit about your own approach to writing. Maybe you've been challenged and inspired by what you've heard in the last few days. Maybe you're thinking about what will happen when you head home and think about making something new. Now, we've had so many masterful plenary sessions and wonderful papers. I want to do something a little bit different tonight. Something a bit more interactive. So I'd like to ask you some questions about your writing process and then structure the rest of my talk on answering those questions. So if you would take out a piece of paper. Participating in that, let's go through these one by one. Number one, I like to write in a noisy, busy environment like a Starbucks. If you said yes to number one, you are much more like Lewis than you are like Tolkien. Lewis had the remarkable ability to write nearly anywhere with nearly anything going on. He actually worked really, really well in a situation of pressure, noise, interruptions, and distractions. That was his preferred way to write. I've been interested to note that during the time that he was living with Janie Moore were some of the most productive years of his career. Now, Warren Lewis and others have given the impression of what's sometimes been called the tyranny of Mrs. Moore, with her constant interruptions to run and fetch something or do some cleaning or whatever. But it's very, very interesting if you track his actual words produced during various years. Those were by far, easily, some of his most productive times. Now, C.S. Lewis, as you know, started writing when he was quite small. And he started writing in collaboration, Boxen, with his older brother, Warren Lewis. C.S. Lewis had writer's block only one time in his entire life. And it was when he moved from Oxford to Cambridge and had a much reduced workload and was spending lots of time in quiet and solitude. Now, you may know the story. Poor Lewis was absolutely frantic. He'd never experienced writer's block before. So he got together with his friend Joy Davidman. I understand there was a fair amount of whiskey involved on that particular night. Joy asked what the problem was. Jack explained, and they started kicking around ideas for the possibility of a book. One of the questions that Joy asked Jack is, have you thought about any maybe concepts that you might pursue? Jack said, I've been thinking a little bit about this long narrative poem that tells the Cupid and Psyche myth. Actually, I've been thinking about it for more than 30 years. She said, you dolt? Well, maybe that's my gloss on the situation. She said, that can't be a long narrative poem. It needs to be a novel. Ding. Right? And that very night he started work on Till We Have Faces. Right? Because once he had found the right form for the idea, then he was ready to move forward. You know that they worked collaboratively on that book. He basically wrote a chapter. He read it out loud to her. She critiqued the chapter. And then they talked together about what should be in the next chapter. Both Douglas and Jack at various places called her a co-author on that particular book. I can relate to this idea of finding it difficult to write when you have too much leisure. We get the idea that what we need to do is we need to get away to a cabin and have long, uninterrupted hours to contemplate. I've just come off a sabbatical. I had 3.5 months, long, uninterrupted blocks of time, and I found myself much less productive than I expected to be. There's something about the energy of interaction. The energy of a conference like this, right, where ideas just come like popcorn, right? And you go home and you think, what was that I was thinking about that thing, what she said, right? And so we often struggle with that. Long and structured days of solitude do not always support high productivity. That's a myth. Some of us write better when we are busy. Lewis liked living in an energetic household, cats, dogs, chickens, people. Some of us are actually distracted by silence, right? How many of you wore headphones and listened to loud music when you did homework? My daughter will have YouTube on, plus she's texting her friends, plus on a different device. Let's see. She's got the computer on YouTube, then she's got her phone, and then she's got the iPad over here on Pinterest. And she's doing all of this at the same time she's doing her math homework. At least that's what she tells me she's doing. But the math seems to get done eventually, and it's very, very difficult for her to function at all. It's very difficult for her to focus if she doesn't have a fairly high level of noise and distraction. I do a better job personally of drafting an essay in quiet, but I do a much better job of editing and revising at a Starbucks. Because when I'm drafting, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to focus on the ideas, their sequence and their proportion. But when I go out to a Starbucks and I look around, it helps me to connect my ideas with the ideas and the understanding of other people. And I do a much better job then of figuring out how is it that I can take what I know and communicate it with energy to somebody else, like that person sitting there or the person who just walked in the door. But I can only copy edit in the library. I don't know. You know. But these places make a difference to us, and it serves us well to be alert to the ways in which environment shapes and enhances our creativity. Are there different phases of the writing process where you need a different kind of environment? Are you kind to yourself in terms of allowing yourself to work in an environment that actually supports the work that you're doing, that energizes you and helps you in terms of your focus? Question number two was this. I have to come up with my own ideas. I can't write when someone gives me an assignment or asks me to write on a particular subject.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, everybody, for being here. This is so great. I'm really glad to get to talk to you about my favorite subject. Let's talk about Charles Williams. And I'll start with talking a little bit about the title, which will start getting us into the subject here. Friendship subspecies Arthuriana. Well, you might know the phrase subspecies aeternitatis, looking at things from the aspect of eternity. So looking at things from a heavenly or an eternal perspective. So I'm arguing today that Charles Williams looked at friendship, as he looked at almost everything, from the perspective of his own remythologized King Arthur legends. And I'm going to ask and answer two main questions today. One is, did Charles Williams collaborate with anyone else on any of his Arthurian works? And then secondly, does he postulate a theory, or maybe even a better word is a theology of friendship in his Arthurian works? And just a spoiler warning, the answer is yes to both of those questions. But I would further add to all of that that you can't really understand Charles Williams's Arthurian mythos or his ideas on friendship without some conception of the occult matters in which he was steeped. So we'll be getting into that just a little bit. Now, I got into this subject after The Fall of Arthur was published in 2013, because that revealed to us that each of the major Inklings, if you want to think of the top four Inklings, Lewis, Tolkien, Williams, and Garfield, had written at least one substantial Arthurian text. We didn't really know how substantial The Fall of Arthur was until then, so it became obvious that this topic had to be studied in some depth. So I assembled a group of 20 marvelous scholars, both established and newcomers, and we put together this volume on the Inklings and King Arthur. And I was specifically curious when I was first reading The Fall of Arthur and starting into this subject about the historical and cultural contexts in which the Inklings were writing their Arthurian works, because there seemed to be an Arthurian upsurge in Britain in the period surrounding the two world wars. Arthur was sometimes used as a powerful figure of social cohesion, moral rectitude, and military might in imagery, in texts and plays, and in propaganda during the two world wars. Sometimes the knightly chivalric sentiments were used to promote engagement in the conflicts, and sometimes they were used to be skeptical of chivalry and of military glory. So Arthur was used in both of those ways at the time. And many important 20th century writers composed important Arthurian works. T.S. Eliot, of course. Thomas Hardy wrote a play, The Tragedy of Isolde. John Masefield, John Cowper Powys, David Jones, James Joyce, if you count Finnegan's Wake as a Tristan and Isolde story. Ezra Pound has a section in Rock Drill that draws from Layamon, and T.H. White. So there were many important Arthurian works, and several of the Inklings' predecessors, students, colleagues, friends, and inspirations were also involved in Arthuriana. George MacDonald, William Morris, A.E. Waite, Arthur Machen, G.K. Chesterton, Roger Lancelin Green, and John Heath Stubbs. So this was obviously something that was going on at the time and an important subject to study. There's going to be a complete inventory of the Inklings' Arthurian works in the forthcoming book, and I do have a copy of that with me, so let me know if you want to see that inventory so you can see who wrote what, you know, what did Barfield write, and so forth. It's fascinating. But this subject that I'm talking about today, and in relation to friendship, does sort of raise an interesting and difficult question. What is an Arthurian work? What counts? Does King Arthur have to be in it? If King Arthur's not in it, do we have to have one of the other characters? So does it have to have Merlin, Gawain, Lancelot? What if it just has a Grail quest? Does it count? What if it has a Grail quest but without a Grail, with some other object being sought? Or what about an object that you're seeking to get rid of instead of to achieve? What if there are just other themes that are really important in the Arthurian works, such as kingship, for instance? Well, this question becomes even more difficult with Charles Williams, because in all of his works, he's asking questions about kingship, statehood, empire, quest, conquest, consciousness, chivalry, and hierarchy, and he saw all these as being Arthurian questions. So we really could go so broad that we could say, well, any of his works are Arthurian, because they're all dealing with these themes that came to their full fruition in his Arthurian works. And in a way, all of his friendships are Arthurian friendships, because he connected his theological, literary, and sexual ideas to King Arthur and the Grail, and connected all of his friendships to those theological, literary, and sexual ideas as well. His was a totalizing imagination, and the Arthurian mythos was his totalizing myth. But there are a few friendships and a few moments of clear collaboration and a few works that stand out. So we'll be mostly emphasizing those today. So to get into it, we'll start with his family and his childhood friends. So his sister, Edith Williams, and his school friend, George Robinson. They attended both secondary school together and then went to University College London for a short time together, starting in 1901. And through Charles Williams' childhood, teenage years, and into college, he and his sister and George had their imaginary worlds, as many children do. We have some evidence of this in an unpublished handwritten booklet at the Marion Wade Center. It used to be called Ministry at the End of 1902, but it's been recataloged as Prince Rudolph of Sylvania. And this is a fragmentary notebook that records this imaginary world. George Robinson has recalled how during these years, the end of secondary school, beginning of college, Williams maintained a sort of running drama concerning one Prince Rudolph, Ruritania, of course, in the background, Princess Rosalind, and a Baron de Bracy, exclamation point in parentheses, a comic character in the Falstaff vein. I was usually Rudolph, Charles's sister Edith was the princess, and Charles was Baron de Bracy, in which character he showed a ripe sense of humor and a power of dramatic portrayal. Now, there are some themes in this early play that are similar to ones that he would develop later in his works. For instance, the form, structure, and subject matter show the seeds of his notion of coherence. Specifically, the notion of the simultaneity of all times, that both the living prince and the dead king are present at once in this play. And in this section right now, I'm drawing from a chapter by Bradley Wells in the forthcoming book in which he examines Williams's early plays in their relation to Arthuriana. And Bradley Wells claims that in this play we see glimpses of the Arthurian city that Williams would develop through his life, the idea of the city and the empire showing forth order in such a way that they portray God's kingdom on earth. So this is not a strictly Arthurian work, but it is interested in questions of kingship, coherence, all times coexisting, and the theology of the city, which for Charles Williams are Arthurian themes, and it's also a work that was clearly collaborative, because the three of them were playing this imaginary game together as kids, as teenagers, creating this world. And so it shows that even his earliest friendships had a literary creative aspect. Now we'll move to the next set of people who were really important to Charles Williams. He met Harold Ayres and Ernest Nottingham at the Working Men's College in 1904, after he had to leave university for financial reasons. And there was a group of five young men who were really close friends at this time: Charles Williams, Harold Ayres, Ernest Nottingham, E.K. Bennett, and Fred Page. Ayres and Nottingham both joined up right away in 1914. Harold Ayres joined the London Rifle Brigade. He was killed on the 20th of May, 1915. Ernest Nottingham joined the London Regiment Civil Service Rifles and was killed in France in action on the 10th of June, 1917, or another source says the 7th of June, 1917. There's a volume called War Letters of Fallen Englishmen, edited by Lawrence Houseman. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, and that's just what it is. It's just a collection of letters home from soldiers and a few nurses, all of whom died in the First World War. And there are two letters by Ernest Nottingham in this collection. One is to Fred Page, who we'll come back to in a moment, a very important friend of Williams, and the other letter is written to Charles Williams. Here are a few selections from this letter from Ernest Nottingham to Charles Williams. I won't read the whole selection, but I want to point out a few things that are interesting for their friendship. I hope you'll be satisfied if I write as I can about things in my mind, and you write your letters just as you do. I need not tell you how I enjoy the play of your nimble mind, even though my experiences here and my reading of events seems to have hardened me against many tendencies you, and he breaks off his thought there. But I want to pick out the phrase there that he's talking about, Williams's nimble mind. And we get the idea that these friendships were very literary friendships. They met in these evening classes. They talked about literature, most likely theology as well. Hadfield makes much of these friendships, saying that they made a very deep impression on Charles Williams, and that it was from their deaths that Williams developed the doctrine of substitution, that he believed that these young men had gone to France to fight in his place. He was medically unfit to fight in the First World War. And Hadfield brings back these memories again at other points throughout her book, including in the Second World War, when Williams was reminded by the new generation of young men in uniform of the ones from when he was their age. And she writes that Harold Ayres and Ernest Nottingham formed for him a pattern of the heavenly society of friendship. And even Greville Lindop in the new biography says that he was haunted, psychologically at least, by friends who died in the war. And he produced many poems in memory of these friends, and many themes of the soldiers being present with him at home in England, or of thoughts of them sort of bringing him psychologically or spiritually to the fields of France as well. The key to his thoughts on friendship and Arthuriana at this time are found in his 1917 collection of poems of conformity, and specifically in the poem from which the title is drawn, Conformity, which praises his friends because, quote, your lives to life, capital L, so mightily conform. So this is what he admired in his friends, was that their lives conformed to the capital L idea of life. And I think that conformity is really the key to his thoughts here and from here on. All of his work is an attempt to conform the individual and the relationships and the state to the heavenly pattern. So you have to think about the word conformity there and how he's using it, because it's not just sort of an ordinary usage, right? He means it in, I would say, a very physical way of pressing people into patterns until their shape conforms to the shape of the mold. His romantic theology is an attempt to conform romantic love to Jesus' earthly life. His exchange and substitution tell us that we should conform our actions to Jesus' death. He made his workplace conform to an Arthurian empire. His wife Florence conformed to the pattern of Beatrice. His later girlfriend Phyllis conformed to the lady at the window. And everything conforms to the pattern of the myth that he developed. Everything is, quote, a microcosmic whole, this mimic sphere. It's a bed of Procrustes, and he's pressing things to conform to these patterns. He writes in Sonnets 10 to his wife, all loves to thee must for their pattern come. I'd say it's an extreme sacramentalism. It's what it is. He calls his days with her hallows. So hallows being the ritual objects associated with the crucifixion. So the days that he's with Michal are hallows. All right, so what does this have to do with Arthuriana then? Well, you can already see a hint of it with the word hallows, because the Grail is perhaps the most noted of the hallows. But in order to answer the relationship between the pattern of friendship and Arthuriana, we have to ask, well, what does friendship conform? What is the pattern for specifically male friendships in this phase of William's life? And the answer is the Knights of the Round Table. That's the pattern to which male friendships conform. So there are quotes from Poems of Conformity from Inland Travel. When all our fellowship were young, we took a task in hand, and west away from London we sought the Holy Land, the high land, the deep land, the land that none can see, the dolorous land of Logres, the coasts of Christenty. And this is addressed to his friends, so he's saying that this is what makes them friends of his, is that they are all knights together on a quest. They travel through England to Carbonek, the place of the Grail. So friendship equals going on a quest together. And then again, in this other snippet, also from Poems of Conformity, he who certainly would be saved from foes that harass, sworn to the fraternity of the House of Sarras. So again, the knights together conforming. They are a Christian brotherhood of Grail knights. They substitute their lives for one another, some dying in war so that others might live. All right, so now we'll talk about Fred Page, and I was not able to find...
Thank you very much for the invitation to be here, Joe and everybody else. And it's my pleasure to speak on Owen Barfield and C.S. Lewis a critical friendship. Mr. Starr, the lifelong friendship between C.S. Lewis and Owen Barfield was critical in two senses. First, their conversations were critical in eroding Lewis's make-atheism and other developing beliefs that were a barrier to his acceptance of a supernatural world and eventually Christianity. Secondly, was critical in that, unusually, it was founded upon and sustained by a mutual opposition, much more particularly in earlier days. In fact, the opposition deepened for each of them the very deep, very meaning of friendship, where a friend could be truly other, offering a different perspective and take on things. This helped Lewis find a wholeness that affirmed both reason and imagination, truth and meaning in harmony. Barfield not only influenced Lewis's thinking, but also had a radical impact on Lewis's manner of writing, particularly the increasing importance he gave to imaginative writing. Barfield himself inclined towards rather esoteric exposition, but Lewis helps us to understand him, though ironically more in the areas in which they agreed than disagreed. Though Barfield and Lewis both confessed to having serious differences, this characteristic quotation from Lewis expresses a view that Barfield would entirely agree with. At the onset, the universe appears packed with will, intelligence, life, and positive qualities. Every tree is a nymph, and every planet a god. Man himself is akin to the gods. The advance of knowledge gradually empties this rich and genial universe, first of its gods, then of its colors, smells, sounds, and tastes. Finally, of solidity itself, as solidity was originally imagined. As these items are taken from the world, they are transferred to the subjective side of the account, classified as our sensations, thoughts, images, or emotions. The subject becomes gorged, inflated, at the expense of the object. But the matter does not end there. The very same method which has emptied the world now proceeds to empty ourselves. The masters of the method soon announced that we were just as mistaken, and mistaken in much the same way, when we attributed souls, or selves, or minds to human organisms, as when we attributed dryads to the trees. We, who have personified all other things, turn out to be ourselves personifications, and thus we arrive at a result uncommonly like zero. Later we shall learn of Barfield's extraordinary second life, where he got increasing recognition in North America. During this later period of Barfield's life, the US novelist and Nobel laureate Saul Bellow wrote, "We are well supplied with interesting writers, but Owen Barfield is not content to be merely interesting. His ambition is to set us free." Free from what? From the prison we have made for ourselves by our ways of knowing, our limited and false habits of thought, our common sense. These, he convincingly argues, have produced a, quote, world of outsides with no insides to them, a brittle surface world, an object world in which we ourselves are mere objects. It is not only what we perceive, but also what we fail to perceive that determines the quality of the world we live in. And what we have collectively chosen not to perceive is the full reality of consciousness, the inside of everything that exists. Barfield said of Lewis that he was in love with the imagination. It could be said of their mutual friend Tolkien that he was in love with language. Barfield was also in love with language. Its creation and sustenance was a very important function of the imagination. In talking about Lewis and Barfield and their larger group of friends, the Inklings, the importance of language is necessarily a prime consideration. My talk tonight is mainly introductory, and as a result, I found it helpful to part frame it in Barfield's biography rather than plunging it into what is often esoteric in his thought. However, I shall introduce characteristic themes and some representative books as we go along. Garfield always made his century, and his long life has much to offer and to challenge a biographer. Much is made of the difference between Barfield and Lewis, not least by Barfield and Lewis themselves. But in fact, Barfield endorsed several writings of Lewis, as did Lewis of Barfield's, which can therefore be taken as indicating some measure of affinity, and can in fact help us to understand some areas of Barfield, whose writings can at times, as I said, be somewhat arcane, whereas Lewis tends usually to be brilliantly clear. These writings that Barfield endorsed include Lewis's The Abolition of Man, his essay sermon Transposition. There are also places where Lewis is clearly trying to explain concepts he owed at least partly to Barfield, which he sometimes acknowledges, such as the chapter, one of these is the chapter Horrid Red Things in his book Miracles, which is also a shorter essay. And other essays like Blusfells and Flanospheres, A Semantic Nightmare. Now, a little bit about, I'll take you a little bit into Barfield's life now. As well as being a significant friend of Lewis, one of the most important in his life, Barfield was also an important member of the Oxford literary group, the Inklings, as I'm sure many of you know, which centered around Lewis, but also Tolkien. The Inklings were friends who met together during the decades of the 1930s, 40s and 50s. Like another important Inkling, Charles Williams, Barfield was a Londoner. He was born in Muswell Hill in North London on 9th of November 1898, just weeks before Lewis. Now, Owen had two sisters and a brother and was the youngest of the siblings. The household was comfortably secular, full of books and music. Barfield described himself as an offspring of, in his words, more or less agnostic parents. The natural household air they breathed was of skepticism about religion. Owen's mother, Lizzie Barfield, was musical, a gifted pianist. His father, Arthur Barfield, had been deprived of a proper school education, but achieved the status of a City of London solicitor. And this is an interesting parallel because, like Barfield's father, Lewis's father was also a lawyer. Lizzie Barfield was a suffragette and was active in feminist politics. And again, there's a link, an affinity here with Lewis's mother, who was, she had a degree, she went for a degree course in maths, in which she achieved the first class, was an active and talented writer. So both men had very talented mothers. Owen's school was in Highgate, near where he first lived in Muswell Hill. It's an area I know well, because I lived there for a year. At school, he shone in gymnastics, which correlated with his love of dancing. Like many of the Inklings, there's lots to Barfield. He's not a stereotype person. In the spring of 1917, Barfield himself was called up to the wartime army. He was then 18. He was anxious to avoid becoming an infantryman because he thought, in his words, the average expectancy of life of a young infantry officer by the time we got to 1916 or 1917 was about 3 weeks after he got out there. As an alternative, he served with the Royal Engineers instead. Like Tolkien before him, he served in the Signal Service. This involved learning about wireless communication and studying the theory of electricity. Barfield, in fact, unlike Lewis and Tolkien, was to have no experience of fighting at the front line. He was eventually posted to Belgium and post-war activity. He found there was little to do with the war over. However, there was a chance provided by the army to get involved in education while waiting demobilization, which helped him to make discoveries in English poetry and encouraged him to write some poetry of his own. As he had already been awarded a scholarship to study at Wadham College, Oxford, all he could do was wait. It was actually October 1919 before he actually got off the train at Oxford Station. It was as an undergraduate that Barfield formed his lifelong and enormously influential friendship with Lewis, being introduced by a mutual friend called Leo Baker. It was this friendship that was to lead to his becoming one of the most important members of the Inklings. Barfield experienced what the New York Times, in his obituary nearly 80 years later, insightfully called an intellectual epiphany. This happened as he was reading through romantic poets such as William Wordsworth, S.T. Coleridge, and John Keats for his university studies. His affinity would be with the romantic movement for the rest of his life, particularly the poet and thinker Coleridge. Barfield remembered that reading experience. What impressed me particularly was the power with which not so much whole poems as particular combinations of words worked on my mind. It seemed like there was some magic in it, and a magic which not only gave me pleasure, but also reacted on and expanded the meanings of the individual words concerned. That moment of illumination seemed to have set the course for his entire life. He became fascinated not only with what happens in the mind of a reader of poetry, but with the mystery of human consciousness itself. In play, when we recognize faces, see flowers in a meadow, or observe a rainbow. Language, Barfield discovered, had a unique power to transform human consciousness. It also captured changes that took place in his consciousness over time. A sort of archaeology could be practiced on language, as he undertook when he wrote his book, History in English Words, published in 1926. More about this book soon. The importance of poetry to the very way that we see the world was a strong element in the friendship of Barfield and Lewis. When the two met, Lewis had far more widely read in poetry than Barfield. Though like Lewis, Barfield grew up in a household full of books, Lewis was always by far the most bookish of the two. While Lewis thought about everything, Barfield tended throughout his life to stay focused on a number of outstanding insights into the nature of language, particularly poetic language, and upon the historical context of human language. These insights always connected with the changing nature of human beings over the ages, what he purposely called an evolution of consciousness. His insights fed into conversations and writings of those who would be associated with the birth of the Inklings, especially Lewis and Tolkien. It would be some years after Barfield's graduation, however, that he would meet Tolkien and stir up the old man's thinking. As with Tolkien, Barfield's main intellectual stimulus, as I said, came from language. Barfield's idea about how poetry and reading brought about changes in how we see the world were to have an enormous impact upon Lewis and later Tolkien. The friendship with Barfield was undoubtedly one of the most significant that Lewis maintained throughout most of the 1920s, especially after Barfield graduated from the English school in 1921 and began working for his distinctive Oxford postgraduate called the B.Litt, which I presume is Bachelor of Literature. This thesis was to form the foundation of his influential book called Poetic Diction. His desire to pursue the relationship between poetry, imagination, and knowledge challenged the teaching resources of the English school at the time. Failing to find him a supervisor, the university finally agreed to let him pursue the B.Litt without one. Lewis, however, as I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear, had no difficulty engaging with his friend on the subject. Before Barfield finished his major book, Poetic Diction, he in fact published two books. I've already mentioned one of them, History in English Words. First of all, I'll mention his very first book, which was published in 1925. It wasn't about language. He brought out an accomplished children's book called The Silk Trumpet, which was published by the distinguished publishing house Faber and Geyer, as it was then called, later Faber and Faber. Lewis read it in manuscript, and soon after starting, he infused in his diary, "I began to read Barfield's fairy tale, The Silver Trumpet, in which with prodigality he squirts out the most suggestive ideas, the loveliest pictures, and the raciest new coined words in wonderful succession. Nothing in its kind can be imagined better. I pointed out that Barfield's first love was undoubtedly language, specifically poetry. And yet he was, in fact, the first of the future Inklings to publish fiction. And fiction from archives of his work are still being published long after his death. You must look up the official Barfield website, there by the estate, and you'll find lots of goodies. Barfield tells the story of Violetta and Gambetta, twin princesses, who have a spell cast over them, which makes them love each other, even though they constantly disagree about almost everything. A visiting prince, who has a silver trumpet, seeks the hand of a princess and falls in love with the sweet tempered Violetta. A servant of the king, a dwarf called with political incorrectness, the little fat Podger, has an emphatic presence in the story. The sound of the trumpet affects all who hear it. Princess Violetta dreams that she is afloat near the bottom of the sea. In an interview, Barfield described the silver trumpet in his words as a symbol of the feeling element in life. Some years after publication, Lewis lent his copy of the story to Tolkien, where it was a great hit in his household. Tolkien became the second of the Inklings in time to write a children's story, in which you all know will be The Hobbit. There are strong affinities of philological interest between Tolkien and Barfield, stronger even than between Barfield and Lewis, especially their archaeological digging into sometimes lost meanings of words. In both, there is a kind of linguistic mysticism. Lewis shared this affinity, but not to the same extent. For Tolkien and Barfield, there are mythologies or a consciousness revealing a worldview, even in individual words. Now, a little bit about History in English Words, published 1926. This, Barfield's second book, is a meditation into the etymology of key words.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. Again, let me apologize for the difference in quality for this final recording from Colin. I tried to remove as much background hiss as possible, and the risk in doing so results in a different type of background noise that is more noticeable if you have good quality headphones. Sadly, I did all my editing on an average pair of headphones and didn't realize the extreme difference it might sound to some of you. Nevertheless, as noted at the beginning, I hope you were able to catch what Colin said without too much difficulty. Besides hearing an excerpt from Colin Duryea, who is the author of many books about Lewis and Tolkien, the first speaking again was Diana Glyer, who recently released a book called Bandersnatch. The second excerpt was from Serena Higgins, who is editing an academic collection entitled The Inklings and King Arthur that is due out in late 2016. Diana and Colin have been on several shows before, and you can find information about that in the show notes for links to them. You can find these show notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, provides links back to where the audio files are located, but also has other features that include a variety of articles related to Lewis. Examples are a daily fact and quote related to him, along with a series exploring quotations attributed to Lewis that may not be from him. At the time this podcast is first posted, I also recently posted the panel discussion where Diana, Serena, and Colin were guests, and I also shared two brief talks from the 2016 Taylor Quilquium. They were my talk related to the Screwtape Letters, and also a talk from Britton Dickinson where he shared a surprising link between those letters and what is commonly known as the Space or Ransom Trilogy. In addition to those new shows, I also post previously released podcasts on my iTunes feed that you can also find at the Podbean address. If you don't know how to find the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllaboutJack.podbean.com. Finally, speaking of Screwtape, my book, C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters, is available online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com.